found. Then, technically speaking, was I not having all the same experiences those other people were having? I tested my theory by standing outside the public library at 5th Avenue and 42nd Street during a gala benefit for heart disease. I made this choice randomly. At closing time, as I was leaving the periodicals room, I noticed well-dressed individuals tossing white cloths over tables and carrying large orchid bouquets into the library's grand entrance hall. And when I asked the blonde gal with a notepad what was going on, she told me about the gala benefit for heart disease. I went home and ate my string beans, but instead of turning on the TV that night, I took the subway back to the library, where the heart disease gala was now in full swing. I heard Satin Doll playing inside. I heard giggles and yelps and big scoops of laughter. I saw approximately 100 long black limousines and shorter black town cars idling alongside the curb, and I considered the fact that nothing more than a series of atoms and molecules combined in a particular way to form something known as a stone wall stood between me and those people inside the public library, dancing to a horn section that was awfully weak in the tenor sax department. But a strange thing happened as I listened. I felt pain. Not in my head, not in my arm, not in my leg, everywhere at once. I told myself there was no difference between being inside and being outside, that it all came down to X's and O's that could be acquired in any number of different ways. But the pain increased to a point where I thought I might collapse, and I limped away. Like all failed experiments, that one taught me something I didn't expect. One key ingredient of so-called experience is the delusional faith that it is unique and special, that those included in it are privileged, and those excluded from it are missing out. And I, like a scientist, unwittingly inhaling toxic fumes from the beaker I was boiling in my lab, had, through sheer physical proximity, been infected by that same delusion and in my drugged state had come to believe I was excluded, condemned to stand shivering outside the public library at 5th Avenue and 42nd Street forever and always, imagining the splendors within. I went to the russet-haired receptionist's desk, balancing my fish on two hands. Juice was starting to leak through the paper. "This is a fish," I told her. She cocked her head, a look on her face like all of a sudden she'd recognized me. "Ah," she said. "Tell Benny pretty soon it's gonna stink." I sat back down. My neighbors in the waiting room were a male and a female, both of the corporate persuasion. I sensed them edging away from me. "I'm a musician," I said, by way of introduction. "Slide guitar." They did not reply. Finally, Benny came out. He looked trim, he looked fit. He wore black trousers and a white shirt buttoned at the neck, but no tie. I understood something for the very first time when I looked at that shirt. I understood that expensive shirts looked better than cheap shirts. The fabric wasn't shiny. No, shiny would be cheap. But it glowed like there was light coming through from the inside. It was a fucking beautiful shirt, is what I'm saying.
"Scotty, man, how goes it?"
Benny said, patting me warmly on the back as we shook hands.
"Sorry to keep you waiting. Hope Sasha took good care of you."
He gestured at the girl I'd been dealing with, whose winsome smile could be roughly translated as, "He's officially not my problem anymore." I gave her a wink, whose exact translation was, "Don't be so sure, darling."
"Here, come on back to my office," Benny said.
He had his arm around my shoulders and was steering me toward a hallway. "Hey, wait, I forgot," I cried, and ran back to get the fish. As I slung the bag from the coffee table into my hands, a little fish juice flew from one corner, and the corporate types both jumped to their feet as if it were nuclear runoff. I looked over at Sasha, expecting to find her cowering, But she was watching it all with a look I would have to call amused. Benny waited for me by the hall. I noticed, with satisfaction, that his skin had gotten more brown since high school. I'd read about this. Your skin gradually darkens from all those cumulative years of sunlight, and Benny's had done so to a point where calling him Caucasian was a stretch.
Shopping?
He asked, eyeing my bundle. Fishing, I told him. Benny's office was awesome, and I don't mean that in the male teenage skateboarding sense. I mean it in the old-fashioned, literal sense. The desk was a giant jet-black oval with a wet-looking surface like the most expensive pianos have. It reminded me of a black ice skating rink. Behind the desk was nothing but view. The whole city flung out in front of us the way street vendors fling out their towels packed with cheap, glittery watches and belts. That's how New York looked. Like a gorgeous, easy thing to have, even for me. I stood just inside the door, holding my fish. Benny went around to the other side of the wet black oval of his desk. It looked frictionless, like you could slide a coin over the surface, and it would float to the edge and drop to the floor.
Have a seat, Scotty, he said.
Wait, I said. This is for you. I came forward and gently set the fish on his desk. I felt like I was leaving an offering at a Shinto shrine on top of the tallest mountain in Japan. The view was tripping me out.
You're giving me a fish?
Benny said.
That's a fish?
Striped bass. I caught it in the East River this morning. Benny looked at me like he was waiting for a cue to laugh.
It's not as polluted as people think, I said, sitting down on a small black chair, one of two facing Benny's desk.
He stood, picked up the fish, came around his desk, and handed it back to me.
Thanks, Scotty, he said. I appreciate the thought, I really do. But a fish is bound to go to waste here at my office.
Take it home and eat it, I said. Benny smiled, his peaceful smile, but he made no move to retrieve the fish. Fine, I thought. I'll eat it myself. My black chair had looked uncomfortable. I thought, lowering myself onto it, this is going to be one of those hellish chairs that makes your ass ache and then go numb. But it was without question the most comfortable chair I had ever sat in, even more comfortable than the leather couch in the waiting room. The couch had put me to sleep. This chair was making me levitate.
Talk to me, Scotty, Benny said. You have a demo tape you want me to hear? You've got an album, a band, songs you're looking to have produced? What's on your mind?
He was leaning against the front of the black lozenge, ankles crossed. One of those poses that appears to be very relaxed, but is actually very tense. As I looked up at him, I experienced several realizations, all in a sort of cascade. One, Benny and I weren't friends anymore, and we never would be. Two, he was looking to get rid of me as quickly as possible with the least amount of hassle. Three, I already knew that would happen. I'd known it before I arrived. Four, it was the reason I had come to see him.
Scotty, you still there?
So, I said,
you're a big shot now, and everyone wants something from you.
Benny hoisted himself onto the edge of his desk and sat there facing me with arms folded in a pose that looked less relaxed than the first one, but was actually more so.
Come on, Scotty, he said. You write me a letter out of nowhere. Now you show up at my office. I'm guessing you didn't come here just to bring me a fish.
No, that was a gift, I said. I came for this reason. I want to know what happened between A and B. Benny seemed to be waiting for more. A is when we were both in the band, chasing the same girl. B is now. I knew instantly that it had been the right move to bring up Alice. I'd said something literally, yes, but underneath that, I'd said something else. We were both a couple of asswipes, and now only I'm an asswipe.
Why?
And underneath that, something else. Once an asswipe, always an asswipe. And deepest of all, you were the one chasing, but she picked me.
I've busted my balls, Benny said. That's what happened.
Ditto. We looked at each other across the black desk, the seat of Benny's power. There was a long, strange pause, and in that pause I felt myself pulling Benny back, or maybe it was him pulling me, back to San Francisco, where we were two out of four flaming dildos. Benny, one of the lousier bass players you were likely to hear, a kid with brownish skin and hair on his hands, and my best friend. I felt a kick of anger so violent it made me dizzy. I closed my eyes and imagined coming at Benny across that desk and ripping off his head, yanking it from the neck of that beautiful white shirt like a knobby weed with long tangled roots. I pictured carrying it into his swank waiting room by his bushy hair and dropping it on Sasha's desk. I rose from my chair, but at that same moment, Benny got up too. Sprang up, I should say, because when I looked at him, he was already standing. Mind if I look out your window? I asked.
Not at all.
He didn't sound afraid, but I smelled that he was. Vinegar. That's what fear smells like. I went to the window. I pretended to look at the view, but my eyes were closed. After a while, I sensed that Benny had moved closer to me.
You still doing any music, Scotty?
He asked gently.
I try, I said.
Mostly by myself, just to keep loose. I was able to open my eyes, but not to look at him.
You were amazing on that guitar,
he said. Then he asked,
Are you married?
Divorced. From Alice.
I know, he said. I meant remarried.
It lasted 4 years.
I'm sorry, buddy.
All for the best, I said. Then I turned to look at Benny. He was standing with his back to the window, and I wondered if he ever bothered to look out, if having so much beauty at close range meant anything at all to him. What about you? I asked.
Married. 3-month-old son.
He smiled. Then, a waffly, embarrassed smile at the thought of his baby boy, like he knew he didn't deserve that much. When I looked past Benny's smile, the fear was right there, that I'd tracked him down to snatch away these gifts life had shoveled upon him, wipe them out in a few emphatic seconds. This made me want to scream with laughter. Hey, buddy, don't you get it? There's nothing you have that I don't have. It's all just X's and O's, and you can come by those a million different ways. But two thoughts distracted me as I stood there, smelling Benny's fear. One, I didn't have what Benny had. Two, he was right. Instead, I thought of Alice. This was something I almost never let myself do, just think of her, as opposed to think about not thinking about her, which I did almost constantly. The thought of Alice broke open in my mind, and I let it fan out, until I saw her hair in the sun, gold. Her hair was gold, and I smelled those oils she used to dab on her wrists with a dropper. Patchouli? Musk? I couldn't remember the names. I saw her face with all the love still in it, no anger, no fear, none of the sorry things I learned to make her feel. Come inside, her face said, and I did. For a minute, I came inside. I looked down at the city. Its extravagance felt wasteful, like gushing oil or some other precious thing Benny was hoarding for himself, using it up so no one else could get any. I thought, if I had a view like this to look down on every day, I would have the energy and inspiration to conquer the world. The trouble is, when you most need such a view, no one gives it to you. I took a long inhale and turned to Benny.
Health and happiness to you, brother, I said,
and I smiled at him for the first and only time. I let my lips open and stretch back, something I very rarely do because I'm missing most of my teeth on both sides. The teeth I have are big and white, so those black gaps come as a real surprise. I saw the shock in Benny's face when he saw. And all at once, I felt strong, as if some balance had tipped in the room, and all of Benny's power, the desk, the view, the levitating chair, suddenly belonged to me. Benny felt it too. Power is like that. Everyone feels it at once. I turned and walked toward the door, still grinning. I felt light, as if I were wearing Benny's white shirt and light was pouring out from inside it.
"Hey, Scotty, hold on,"
Benny said, sounding shaken. He veered back toward his desk, but I kept walking, my grin leading the way into the hall and back toward the reception area where Sasha sat, my shoes whispering on the carpet with each slow, dignified step. Benny caught up with me and handed me a business card, sumptuous paper with embossed print. It felt precious. I held it very carefully. "President," I read.
"Don't be a stranger, Scotty," Benny said.
He sounded bewildered, as if he'd forgotten how I had come to be there, as if he'd invited me himself, and I were leaving prematurely.
"You ever have any music you want me to hear, send it on."
I couldn't resist one last look at Sasha. Her eyes were serious, almost sad, but she was still flying the flag of her pretty smile. "Take care, Scotty," she said. Outside the building, I walked directly to the box where I had mailed my letter to Benny a few days earlier. I bent my neck and squinted up at the tower of green glass, trying to count the floors to 45. And only then did I notice that my hands were empty. I'd left my fish in Benny's office. This struck me as hilarious, and I laughed out loud, imagining the corporate types seating themselves in the levitating chairs in front of Benny's desk, one of them lifting the wet, heavy bag from the floor and then recognizing it. "Oh, Christ, it's that guy's fish!" Dropping it, revolted. And what would Benny do? I wondered as I walked slowly toward the subway. Would he dispose of the fish forever then and there, or would he put it in the office refrigerator and take it home that night to his wife and baby son and tell them about my visit? And if he got that far, was it possible that he might open up the bag and take a look just for the hell of it? I hoped so. I knew he'd be amazed. It was a shiny, beautiful fish. I wasn't good for much of the rest of that day. I get a lot of headaches from eye damage I had as a kid, and the pain is so intense that it throws off bright, excruciating pictures. That afternoon, I lay on my bed and closed my eyes and saw a burning heart suspended in darkness, shooting off light in every direction. It wasn't a dream, because nothing happened. The heart just hung there. Having gone to bed in the late afternoon, I was up and out of my apartment and under the Williamsburg Bridge with my line in the East River well before sunrise. Sammy and Dave showed up soon after. Dave didn't actually care about fish. He was there to watch the East Village females on their early morning jogs before they went to school at NYU or to work at a boutique or whatever East Village girls do with their days. Dave complained about their jog bras, which didn't allow enough bounce for his satisfaction. Sammy and I barely listened. That morning, when Dave started up, I felt an inclination to speak. "You know, Dave," I said, "I think that's the point."
"What's the point?"
"That their breasts don't bounce," I said. "It hurts them. That's why they wear jog bras in the first place." He gave me a wary look.
"Since when are you the expert?"
"My wife used to jog," I said.
"Used to? You mean she quit?"
"She quit being my wife.
She probably still jogs."
It was a quiet morning. I heard the slow pop-pop of tennis balls on the courts behind the Williamsburg Bridge. Aside from the joggers and tennis players, There were usually a few junkies out by the river in the early mornings. I always looked for one particular couple, a male and female, in thigh-length leather jackets, with skinny legs and ruined faces. They had to be musicians. I'd been out of the game a long time, but I could spot a musician anywhere. The sun rose, big and shiny and round, like an angel lifting her head. I'd never seen it so brilliant out there. Silver poured over the water. I wanted to jump in and swim. Pollution? I thought. Gimme some more. And then I noticed the girl. I spotted her, peripherally, because she was small and ran with a high, leaping gait that was different from the others. She had light brown hair, and when the sunlight touched it, something happened that you couldn't miss. Rumpelstiltskin, I thought. Dave was gaping at her, and even Sammy turned to look, but I kept my eyes on the river, watching my line for a tug. I saw the girl without having to look.
"Hey, Scotty,"
Dave said.
"I think your wife just ran by."
"I'm divorced," I said.
"Well, that was her."
"No," I said. "She lives in San Francisco."
"Maybe she's your next wife," Sammy suggested.
"She's my next wife," Dave said.
"And you know the first thing I'm gonna teach her? Don't clamp them down, let them bounce."
I looked at my line flicking in the sun. My luck was gone. I knew I wouldn't catch anything. Soon I had to be at work. I reeled in my line and began walking north along the river. The girl was already a long way ahead, her hair shaking with every step. I followed her, but at such a distance that I wasn't following her, really. I was just walking in the same direction. My eyes held her so tightly that I didn't even notice the junky couple in my path until they'd almost passed me. They were huddled up against each other, looking haggard and sexy the way young people can, for a little while, until they just look haggard. "Hey," I said, stepping in their way. We must have seen each other 20 times on that river, but the guy aimed his sunglasses at me like he'd never seen me before, and the girl didn't look at me at all. "Are you musicians?" I asked. The guy turned away, shaking me off. But the girl looked up. Her eyes seemed raw, peeled away, and I wondered if the sun hurt them, and why her boyfriend or husband or whatever he was didn't give her his glasses. "He's awesome," she said, using the word in the male teenage skateboarding sense. Or maybe not, I thought. Maybe she meant it literally. "I believe you," I said. "I believe he's an awesome musician." I reached into my shirt pocket and took out Benny's card. I'd used a piece of Kleenex to remove it from yesterday's jacket and place it in today's shirt, making sure not to bend or fold or smudge it. Its embossed letters reminded me of a Roman coin. "Call this man," I said. "He runs a record label. Tell him Scotty sent you." They both looked at the card, squinting in the angled sunlight. "Call him," I said. "He's my buddy."
"Sure,"
the guy said, without conviction. "I really hope you will," I said, but I felt helpless. I could do this only once. I would never have that card again. While the guy studied the card, the girl looked at me. "He'll call," she said, and then she smiled. Small, orderly teeth, the kind you only get from wearing braces. "I'll make him." I nodded and turned, leaving the junkies behind. I walked north, forcing my eyes to see as far as they could see. But the freckled jogger had vanished while I looked away. "Hey," I heard behind me, two ragged voices. When I turned, they called out, "Thanks," both at the same time. It had been so long since anyone had really thanked me for something. "Thanks," I said to myself. I said it again and again, wanting to hold in my mind the exact sound of their voices, to feel again the kick of surprise in my chest. Is there some quality of warm spring air that causes birds to sing more loudly? I asked myself that question as I took the overpass across the FDR onto East 6th Street. Flowers were just coming open in the trees. I trotted underneath them, smelling their powdery pollen as I hurried toward my apartment. I wanted to drop off my jacket at the dry cleaner on my way to work. I'd been looking forward to it since yesterday. I'd left the jacket crumpled on the floor beside my bed, and I would bring it in like that, all used up. I'd toss it on the counter oh so casually, daring the gal to challenge me. But how could she? I've been somewhere, and I need my jacket cleaned, I would say, like anyone else. And she would make it new again. B. Chapter 7. A to B. 1. Stephanie and Benny had lived in Crandale a year before they were invited to a party. It wasn't a place that warmed easily to strangers. They'd known that going in and hadn't cared. They had their own friends. But it wore on Stephanie more than she'd expected, dropping off Chris for kindergarten, waving or smiling at some blonde mother releasing blonde progeny from her SUV or Hummer, and getting back a pinched, quizzical smile whose translation seemed to be, "Who are you again?" How could they not know, after months of daily mutual sightings? They were snobs, or idiots, or both, Stephanie told herself. Yet she was inexplicably crushed by their coldness. During that first winter in town, the sister of one of Benny's artists sponsored them for membership to the Crandale Country Club. After a process only slightly more arduous than applying for citizenship, they were admitted in late June. They arrived at the club on their first day, carrying bathing suits and towels, not realizing that the CCC, as it was known, provided its own monochromatic towels to reduce the cacophony of poolside color. In the ladies' locker room, Stephanie passed one of the blondes whose children went to Chris's school, and for the first time, she got an actual, "Hello," her own appearance in two separate locations having apparently fulfilled some triangulation Kathy required as proof of personhood. That was her name, Kathy. Stephanie had known it from the beginning. Kathy was carrying a tennis racket. She wore a tiny white dress beneath which white tennis shorts, hardly more than underpants, were just visible. Her prodigious childbearing had left no mark on her narrow waist and well-tanned biceps. Her shining hair was in a tight ponytail, stray wisps secured with gold bobby pins. Stephanie changed into her bathing suit and met Benny and Chris near the snack bar. As they stood there uncertainly, holding their colorful towels, Stephanie recognized a distant thump-thump of tennis balls. The sound induced a swoon of nostalgia. Like Benny, she came from nowhere, but a different type of nowhere. His was the urban nowhere of Daly City, California, where his parents had worked to a point of total absence while a weary grandmother raised Benny and his four sisters. But Stephanie hailed from suburban, midwestern nowhere, and there had been a club whose snack bar served thin, greasy burgers rather than salade niçoise with fresh-seared tuna, like this one, but where tennis had been played on sun-cracked courts and where Stephanie had achieved a certain greatness at around age 13. She hadn't played since. At the end of that first day, dopey from sun, they'd showered, changed back into their clothes, and sat on a flagstone terrace where a pianist rolled out harmless melodies on a shining upright. The sun was beginning to set. Chris tumbled on some nearby grass with two girls from his kindergarten class. Benny and Stephanie sipped gin and tonics and watched the fireflies.
"So this is what it's like," Benny said.
A number of possible replies occurred to Stephanie. Allusions to the fact that they still didn't know anyone. Her suspicion that there wasn't anyone worth knowing. but she let them pass. It was Benny who had chosen Crandale, and in some deep way, Stephanie understood why. They'd flown in private jets to islands owned by rock stars, but this country club was the farthest distance Benny had traveled from the dark-eyed grandmother in Daly City. He'd sold his record label last year. How better to mark success than by going to a place where you didn't belong? Stephanie took Benny's hand and kissed a knuckle. "Maybe I'll buy a tennis racket," she said. The party invitation came 3 weeks later. The host, a hedge fund manager known as Duck, had invited them after learning that Benny had discovered the Conduits, Duck's favorite rock group, and released their albums. Stephanie had found the two deep in conversation by the pool when she returned from her first tennis lesson.
"I wish they'd get back together," Duck mused. "Whatever happened to that spastic guitarist?"
"Bosco? He's still recording," Benny said tactfully. "His new album will be out in a couple of months. A to B. His solo work is more interior."
He left out the part about Bosco being obese, alcoholic, and cancer-ridden. He was their oldest friend. Stephanie had perched on the edge of Benny's deck chair, flushed because she'd hit well, her topspin still intact, her serve slicingly clear. She'd noticed one or two blonde heads pausing by the court to watch and had been proud of how different she looked from these women, her cropped dark hair and tattoo of a Minoan octopus encompassing one calf, her several chunky rings. Although it was also true that she'd bought a tennis dress for the occasion, slim and white, tiny white shorts underneath, the first white garment Stephanie had owned in her adult life. At the cocktail party, she spotted Kathy, who else, across a crowded expanse of terrace. As she was wondering whether she would again merit an actual hello or be downgraded to a crabbed, "Who are you?" smile, Kathy caught Stephanie's eye and began moving toward her. Introductions were made. Kathy's husband, Clay, wore seersucker shorts and a pink Oxford shirt, an ensemble that might have seemed ironic on a different sort of person. Kathy wore classic navy, setting off the bright blue of her eyes. Stephanie sensed Benny's gaze lingering on Kathy and felt herself go tense, a residual spasm of unease that passed as quickly as his attention. He was now talking to Clay. Kathy's blonde hair hung loose, still bobby pinned at the sides. Stephanie wondered idly how many bobby pins the woman went through in a week.
"I've seen you on the court," Kathy said.
"It's been a while," Stephanie said. "I'm just getting back into it."
"We should rally sometime."
"Sure," Stephanie said casually, but she felt her heartbeat in her cheeks, and when Clay and Kathy moved on, she was beset by a giddiness that shamed her. It was the silliest victory of her life.
2. Within a few months, anyone would have said that Stephanie and Kathy were friends. They had a standing tennis date, 2 mornings a week, and they'd become successful doubles partners in an inner club league, playing other blonde women in small tennis dresses from nearby towns. There was an easy symmetry to their lives right down to their names, Kath and Steph, Steph and Kath, and their sons, who were in the same first grade class. Chris and Colin, Colin and Chris. How was it that of all the names Stephanie and Benny had considered when she was pregnant, Xanadu, Peekaboo, Ronaldo, Cricket, they'd ended up choosing the single one that melded flawlessly with the innocuous Crandale namescape? Kathy's elevated status in the pecking order of local blondes gave Stephanie an easy and neutral entree, a protected status that absorbed even her short dark hair and tattoos. She was different, but okay, exempt from the feral scratching that went on among some others. Stephanie would never have said that she liked Kathy. Kathy was a Republican, one of those people who used the unforgivable phrase, meant to be,
usually when describing her own good fortune or the disasters that had befallen other people. She knew little about Stephanie's life, would surely have been dumbstruck to learn, for example, that the celebrity reporter who had made headlines a few years back by assaulting Kitty Jackson, the young movie star, while interviewing her for Details magazine, was Stephanie's older brother, Jules. Occasionally, Stephanie wondered whether her friend might understand more than she gave her credit for. "I know you hate us," she imagined Kathy thinking, "and we hate you too. And now that we've resolved that, let's go rub out those bitches from Scarsdale." Stephanie loved the tennis with a ravenous aggression that half embarrassed her. She dreamed about line calls and backhands. Kathy was still the better player, but the margin was shrinking, a fact that seemed to pique and amuse them equally. As partners and opponents, mothers and neighbors, Steph and Kath were seamlessly matched. The only problem was Benny. Stephanie hadn't believed him at first when he told her, the summer after the invasion, their second in Crandale, that he felt people giving him odd looks by the pool. She'd assumed he meant women who were admiring the clutch of brown muscles above his swim trunks, his wide, dark eyes, and she'd snipped, "Since when do you have a problem with being looked at?" But Benny hadn't meant that, and soon Stephanie felt it too, some hesitation or question around her husband. It didn't seem to bother Benny deeply. He'd been asked, "What kind of name is Salazar?" enough times in his life to be fairly immune to skepticism about his origins and race, and he'd perfected an arsenal of charms to obliterate that skepticism, especially in women. Around the middle of that second summer, at another hedge fund-fueled cocktail party, Benny and Stephanie found themselves chatting, along with Kathy and Clay, or Cardboard, as they secretly called him, and some others, with Bill Duff, a local congressman who had come from a meeting with the Council on Foreign Relations. The topic was the presence of Al-Qaeda in the New York area. "Operatives were present," Bill confided, "especially in the outer boroughs, possibly in communication with one another." Stephanie noticed Clay's pale eyebrows suddenly lift, and his head gave a single odd jerk as if he had water in one ear. But the question was, how strong a link did they have to the mothership? Here Bill laughed, because any kook with a grudge could call himself Al-Qaeda, but if he lacked money, training, backup... Clay gave another quick headshake, then flicked his eyes at Benny to his right. It made no sense to allocate resources. Bill paused, mid-sentence, clearly baffled. Another couple broke in, and Benny took Stephanie's arm and moved away. His eyes looked placid, almost sleepy, but his grip hurt her wrist. They left the party soon after. Benny paid the babysitter, a 16-year-old, nicknamed Scooter, and drove her home. He was back before Stephanie had even glanced at the clock and reflected on Scooter's prettiness. She heard him setting the burglar alarm. Then he thundered up the stairs in a way that made Sylph, the cat, dive under the bed in terror. Stephanie ran from the bedroom and met Benny at the top of the stairs.
"What the fuck am I doing here?" he cried.
"Shh, you'll wake up, Chris."
"It's a horror show."
"That was ugly," she said, "although Clay's an ex-"
"You're defending them?"
"Of course not, but he's one guy."
"You think everyone in that group didn't know what was going on?"
Stephanie was afraid that it might be true. Had they all known? She wanted Benny not to think so. "That's totally paranoid. Even Kathy says,
again, look at you."
He stood at the top of the stairs with fists clenched. Stephanie went to him and took him into her arms, and Benny relaxed against her, almost knocking her over. They held each other until his breathing slowed. Stephanie said softly, "Let's move." Benny pulled back, startled.
I mean it, she said. I don't give a shit about these people.
It was an experiment, right? Moving to a place like this.
Benny didn't answer. He looked around them at the floors, whose rose parquet designs he'd sanded himself on hands and knees, not trusting whomever they might pay for such intricate work. At the windows in their bedroom door that he'd spent weeks excavating with a razor from under layers of paint. At the stairwell nooks he'd ruminated over, placing one objet after another inside and adjusting the lights. His father had been an electrician. Benny could light anything.
Let them move, he said. This is my fucking house.
Fine. But if it comes to that, I'm saying we can go. Tomorrow, in a month, in a year.
I want to die here, Benny said.
Jesus,
Stephanie said, at which point they were stung by sudden, itchy laughter that soon became hysterics. Both of them doubled over on the parquet, shushing each other. So they'd stayed. After that, when Benny noticed Stephanie putting on her tennis whites in the morning, he'd say,
"Going to play with the fascists?"
Stephanie knew he wanted her to quit, renounce her partnership with Kathy, to protest cardboard's bigotry and idiocy. But Stephanie had no intention of quitting. If they were going to live in a place whose social life revolved around a country club, she sure as hell was going to stay on good terms with the woman who guaranteed her easy assimilation. She had no wish to be an outcast like Noreen, their neighbor to the right, who had clanging mannerisms and wore oversized sunglasses, whose hands shook violently from medication, Stephanie presumed. Noreen had three lovely, anxious children, but none of the women talked to her. She was a ghost. No, thank you, Stephanie thought. In the fall, when the weather cooled, she began arranging her tennis games for later in the day, when Benny wouldn't be home to see her change clothes. Now that she was working freelance for LaDahl's PR firm, scheduling Manhattan meetings as she wished, this was easy. It was slightly deceptive, of course, but only through omission, to protect Benny from knowledge that distressed him. Stephanie never denied having played, if he asked. And besides, hadn't he engaged in his share of deceptions over the years? Didn't he owe her a few of her own? 3. The following spring, Stephanie's older brother, Jules, was paroled from Attica Correctional Facility and came to live with them. He'd been gone 5 years, the first on Rikers Island awaiting trial for the attempted rape of Kitty Jackson, another 4 after the rape charge was dropped at Kitty Jackson's request, and he was convicted of kidnapping and aggravated assault, outrageous given that the starlet had walked into Central Park with Jules of her own free will and sustained not a single injury. In fact, she'd ended up testifying for the defense. But the DA had persuaded the jury that Kitty's support for Jules was a version of Stockholm Syndrome.
The fact that she insists on protecting this man is further evidence of how deeply he has hurt her,
Stephanie recalled him intoning at her brother's trial, which she'd watched over 10 agonizing days, trying to look upbeat. In prison, Jules had seemed to regain the composure he'd lost so spectacularly in the months before the assault. He went on medication for his bipolar disorder and made peace with the end of his marriage engagement. He edited a weekly prison newspaper, and his coverage of the impact of 9/11 on the lives of inmates won him a special citation from the Penn Prison Writing Program. Jules had been allowed to come to New York and receive the award, and Benny, Stephanie, and her parents had all wept through his halting acceptance speech. He'd taken up basketball, shed his gut, and miraculously overcome his eczema. He seemed ready, finally, to resume the serious journalism career he'd come to New York more than 20 years before to pursue. When the parole board granted him early release,
Stephanie and Benny had joyfully offered to house him while he got back on his feet. But now, 2 months after Jules' arrival, an ominous stasis had set in. He'd had a few interviews early on that he'd approached in a state of sweaty terror, but nothing had come of them. Jules doted on Chris, spending hours while Chris was at school assembling vast cities out of microscopic Lego pieces to surprise him when he returned. But with Stephanie, her brother maintained a sardonic distance, seeming to regard her futile scurrying, this morning for example, as the three of them rushed towards school and work, with wry bemusement. His hair was straggly and his face looked deflated, sapped in a way that pained Stephanie.
"You driving into the city?"
Benny asked, as Stephanie hustled breakfast plates into the sink. She wasn't driving in, yet. As the weather warmed, she'd resumed her morning tennis games with Kathy. But she'd found a clever new way to edit these games out of Benny's view. She kept her tennis whites at the club, dressed for work in the morning, kissed him goodbye, then proceeded to the club to change and play. Stephanie minimized the deception by making the lie purely chronological. If Benny asked where she was going, she always cited an actual meeting that would take place later on that day. So if he inquired in the evening how it had gone, she could answer honestly.
"I'm meeting Bosco at 10, she said.
Bosco was the only rocker whose PR she still handled. The meeting was actually at 3.
"Bosco before noon?"
Benny asked.
"Was that his idea?"
Stephanie instantly saw her mistake. Bosco spent his nights in an alcoholic fog. The chances of his being conscious at 10 a.m. were nil.
"I think so," she said.
The act of lying to her husband's face bringing on a tingly vertigo.
"You're right, though. It's weird."
"It's scary," Benny said.
He kissed Stephanie goodbye and headed for the door with Chris.
"Will you call me after you see him?"
In that moment, Stephanie knew she would cancel her game with Kathy, stand Kathy up, in essence, and drive to Manhattan to meet Bosco at 10. There was no other way. When they'd gone, Stephanie felt the tension that always seemed to arise when she was alone with Jules, her own unspoken questions about his plans and timetable clashing silently with his armature against them. Beyond Lego assembly, it was hard to know what Jules did all day. Twice Stephanie had come home to find the TV in her bedroom tuned to a porn channel, and this had so disturbed her that she'd asked Benny to bring the extra set to the guest room where Jules was staying. She went upstairs and left a voicemail on Kathy's cell phone canceling their game. When she returned to the kitchen, Jules was peering out the window of the breakfast nook.
"What's the deal with your neighbor?"
he asked.
"Noreen?"
Stephanie said.
"We think she's nuts."
"She's doing something near your fence."
Stephanie went to the window. It was true. She glimpsed Noreen's over-bleached ponytail, like a caricature of everyone else's subtly natural highlights, moving up and down beside the fence. Her giant black sunglasses gave her the cartoonish look of a fly or a space alien. Stephanie shrugged, impatient with Jules for even having the time to fixate on Noreen.
"I've got to run," she said.
"Can I hitch a ride to the city?"
Stephanie felt a little pop in her chest.
"Of course," she said. "You have a meeting?"
"Not really. I just feel like getting out."
As they walked to the car, Jules glanced behind them and said,
"I think she's watching us. Noreen, through the fence."
"Wouldn't surprise me."
"You just let that go on?"
"What can we do? She's not hurting us. She's not even on our property."
"She could be dangerous."
"Takes one to know one, eh?"
"Not nice," Jules said.
In the Volvo, Stephanie slipped an advance copy of Bosco's new album, A to B, into the CD player out of some sense that in doing so, she was strengthening her alibi. Bosco's recent albums consisted of gnarled little ditties accompanied by a ukulele. It was only out of friendship that Benny still released them.
Can I please turn this off?
Jules asked after two songs, then did so before Stephanie had answered.
This is who we're going to see?
We? I thought you were hitching a ride.
Can I come with you?
Jules asked.
Please?
He sounded humble and plaintive, a man with nowhere to go and nothing to do. Stephanie wanted to scream. Was this some kind of punishment for lying to Benny? In the past 30 minutes, she'd been forced to cancel a tennis game she was dying to play, piss Kathy off, embark on an invented errand to visit a person who was sure to be unconscious, and now bring her rudderless, hypercritical brother along to witness the demise of her alibi.
I'm not sure how much fun it'll be, she said.
That's okay, Jules said. I'm used to not fun.
He watched nervously as Stephanie maneuvered from the hutch onto the Cross Bronx Expressway. Being in the car seemed to worry him. When they had fully entered the flow of traffic, he asked,
Are you having an affair?
Stephanie stared at him.
You're out of your mind. Watch the road!
Why are you asking me that?
You seem jumpy. You and Benny both. Not like I remember you guys.
Stephanie was stricken. Benny seems jumpy? The old fear rose in her so quickly, like a hand at her throat, despite Benny's promise 2 years ago when he turned 40 and the fact that she had no reason to doubt him.
You seem, I don't know, polite.
Compared to people in prison? Jules smiled.
Okay, he said. Maybe it's just the place. Crandale, New York,
he said, elongating the words.
I'll bet it's crawling with Republicans.
About half and half. Jules turned to her, incredulous.
Do you socialize with Republicans?
It happens, Jules.
You and Benny? Hanging out with Republicans?
Are you aware that you're shouting?
Watch the road!
Jules bellowed. Stephanie did, her hands shaking on the wheel. She felt like turning around and taking her brother back home, but that would involve missing her non-existent meeting.
I go away for a few years and the whole fucking world is upside down,
Jules said angrily.
Buildings are missing. You get strip searched every time you go to someone's office. Everybody sounds stoned because they're emailing people the whole time they're talking to you. Tom and Nicole are with different people. And now my rock and roll sister and her husband are hanging around with Republicans. What the fuck?
Stephanie took a long, calming breath. What are your plans, Jules?
I told you. I want to come with you and meet this.
I mean, what are you going to do? There was a long pause. Finally, Jules said,
I have no idea.
Stephanie glanced at him. They'd turned onto the Henry Hudson Parkway, and Jules was looking at the river, his face devoid of energy or hope. She felt a contraction of fear around her heart. When you first came to New York, she said, all those years ago, you were full of ideas.
Jules snorted. Who isn't, at 24?
I mean, you had a direction. He'd graduated from the University of Michigan a couple of years before. One of Stephanie's freshman suitemates at NYU had left school for treatment of anorexia, and Jules had occupied the girl's room for 3 months, wandering the city with a notebook, crashing parties at the Paris Review. By the time the anorexic returned, he'd gotten himself a job at Harper's, an apartment on 81st and York, and 3 roommates, 2 of whom now edited magazines. The third had won a Pulitzer. I don't get it, Jules, Stephanie said. I don't get what happened to you. Jules stared at the glittering skyline of Lower Manhattan without recognition.
I'm like America, he said.
Stephanie swung around to look at him, unnerved. What are you talking about? She said. Are you off your meds?
Our hands are dirty, Jules said.
4. Stephanie parked in a lot on 6th Avenue, and she and Jules picked their way into Soho through crowds of shoppers holding room-sized bags from Crate and Barrel.
So, who the hell is this Bosco person?
Jules asked. Remember the Conduits? He was the guitarist. Jules stopped walking.
That's who we're going to see? Bosco from the Conduits? The skinny redhead?
Yeah, well, he's changed a little. They turned south on Worcester. Sunlight skipped off the cobblestones, releasing in Stephanie's mind a pale balloon of memory. Shooting the Conduits' first album cover on this very street, laughing, jittery, Bosco powdering his freckles while the photographer fiddled. The memory mooned her as she rang Bosco's bell and waited, praying silently. Please don't be home. Please don't answer. Please. Then at least the charade part of the day would be over. No voice on the intercom, just a buzz. Stephanie pushed open the door with a disoriented sense that maybe she had arranged to meet Bosco at 10. Or had she pressed the wrong bell? They went in and called for the elevator. It took a long time to descend, grinding inside its tube.
Is that thing healthy?
Jules asked. You're welcome to wait down here.
Quit trying to get rid of me.
Bosco was unrecognizable as the scrawny, stovepipe-panted practitioner of a late-80s sound somewhere between punk and ska, a hive of red-headed mania who had made Iggy Pop look indolent on stage. More than once, club owners had called 911 during Conduit's shows, convinced that Bosco was having a seizure. Nowadays, he was huge, from medications, he claimed, both post-cancer and antidepressant. But a glance into his trash can nearly always revealed an empty gallon box of Friendship Rocky Road ice cream. His red hair had devolved into a stringy gray ponytail. An unsuccessful hip replacement had left him with the lurching, belly-hoisting walk of a refrigerator on a hand truck. Still, he was awake, dressed, even shaven. The blinds of his loft were up, and a tinge of shower humidity hung in the air, pleasantly cut by the smell of brewing coffee.
I was expecting you at 3,
Bosco said. I thought we said 10, Stephanie said, looking inside her purse to avoid his gaze. Did I get the time wrong? Bosco was no fool. He knew she was lying. But he was curious, and his curiosity fell naturally on Jules. Stephanie introduced them.
It's an honor, Jules said gravely.
Bosco scrutinized him for signs of irony before shaking his hand. Stephanie perched on a folding chair near the black leather recliner where Bosco spent the bulk of his time. It was positioned by a dusty window, through which the Hudson River and even a bit of Hoboken were visible. Bosco brought Stephanie coffee and then began a juddering immersion into his chair, which suctioned around him in a gelatinous grip. They were meeting to discuss PR for A to B. Now that Benny had corporate bosses to answer to, he couldn't spend a dime on Bosco beyond the cost of producing and shipping his CD. So Bosco paid Stephanie by the hour to act as his publicist and booking agent. These were mostly symbolic titles. He'd been too sick to do much of anything for the last two albums, and his lassitude had been roughly matched by the world's indifference toward him.
Whole different story this time,
Bosco began.
I'm gonna make you work, Steffi babe. This album is gonna be my comeback.
Stephanie assumed he was joking. But he met her gaze evenly from within the folds of black leather. Comeback? She asked. Jules had been wandering the loft, eyeing the framed gold and platinum Conduit albums paving the walls, the few guitars Bosco hadn't sold off, and his collection of pre-Columbian artifacts, which he hoarded in pristine glass cases and refused to sell. At the word comeback, Stephanie felt her brother's attention suddenly engage.
The album's called A to B, right?
Bosco said.
And that's the question I want to hit straight on. How did I go from being a rock star to being a fat fuck no one cares about? Let's not pretend it didn't happen.
Stephanie was too startled to respond.
I want interviews, features, you name it,
Bosco went on.
Fill up my life with that shit. Let's document every fucking humiliation. This is reality, right? You don't look good anymore 20 years later, especially when you've had half your guts removed. Time's a goon, right? Isn't that the expression?
Jules had drifted over from across the room.
I've never heard that, he said.
Time is a goon? Would you disagree?
Bosco said, a little challengingly. There was a pause.
No,
Jules said. Look, Stephanie said. I love your honesty, Bosco.
Don't give me I love your honesty, Bosco,
he said.
Don't get all PR-y on me.
I'm your publicist, Stephanie reminded him.
Yeah, but don't start believing that shit,
Bosco said.
You're too old.
I was trying to be tactful, Stephanie said. The bottom line is, no one cares that your life has gone to hell, Bosco. It's a joke that you think this is interesting. If you were still a rock star, it might be, but you aren't a rock star. You're a relic.
That is harsh,
Jules said. Bosco laughed.
She's pissed that I called her old.
True, Stephanie admitted.
Jules looked from one to the other, uneasy. Any sort of conflict seemed to rattle him. Look, Stephanie said, I can tell you this is a great, innovative idea and let it die on its own, or I can level with you. It's a ridiculous idea. Nobody cares.
You haven't heard the idea yet,
Bosco said. Jules carried over a folding chair and sat down.
I want a tour,
Bosco said.
Like I used to, doing all the same stuff on stage. I'm gonna move like I moved before, only more so.
Stephanie put down her cup. She wished Benny were here. Only Benny could appreciate the depth of self-delusion she was witnessing.
Let me get this straight, she said. You want to do a lot of interviews and press around the fact that you're an ailing and decrepit shadow of your former self? And then you want to do a tour?
A national tour.
A national tour, performing as if you were that former self.
Bingo.
Stephanie took a deep breath. I see a few problems, Bosco.
I thought you might,
he said, winking at Jules.
Shoot.
Well, number one, getting a writer interested in this is going to be tough.
I'm interested, Jules said, and I'm a writer.
God help me, Stephanie almost said, but restrained herself. She hadn't heard her brother call himself a writer in many years.
Okay, so you've got one writer interested.
He gets everything,
Bosco said. He turned to Jules.
You get everything, total access. You can watch me take a shit if you want to.
Jules swallowed.
I'll think about it.
I'm just saying, there are no limits.
Okay. Stephanie began again. So, you've...
You can film me, too,
Bosco told Jules.
You can make a documentary if you're interested.
Jules was starting to look afraid.
Can I finish a fucking sentence here? Stephanie asked. You've got a writer for this story that will be of no interest to anyone.
Can you believe this is my publicist?
Bosco asked Jules.
Should I fire her?
Good luck finding someone else,
Stephanie said. Now, about the tour. Bosco was grinning, sealed inside his gluttonous chair that for anyone else would have qualified as a couch. She felt sudden pity for him.
Getting bookings isn't gonna be easy, she said gently. I mean, you haven't toured in a while. You're not... You say you want to perform, like before, but...
Bosco was laughing in her face, but Stephanie soldiered on.
Physically, you aren't... I mean, your health...
She was dancing around the fact that Bosco wasn't remotely capable of performing in his old manner, and that trying to do so would kill him, probably sooner rather than later.
Don't you get it, Steph? Bosco finally exploded. That's the whole point. We know the outcome, but we don't know when or where or who will be there when it finally happens. It's a suicide tour.
Stephanie started to laugh. The idea struck her as inexplicably funny, but Bosco was abruptly serious.
I'm done, he said. I'm old. I'm sad. That's on a good day. I want out of this mess, but I don't want to fade away. I want to flame away. I want my death to be an attraction, a spectacle, a mystery, a work of art. Now, Lady PR, he said, gathering up his drooping flesh and leaning toward her, eyes glittering in his overblown head. You try to tell me no one's going to be interested in that. Reality TV, hell, it doesn't get any realer than this. Suicide is a weapon that we all know. But what about an art?
He watched Stephanie anxiously. A big, ailing man with one bold idea left, ablaze with hope that she would like it. There was a long pause while Stephanie tried to assemble her thoughts. Jules spoke first.
It's genius.